From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The governor of Puerto Rico is warning residents to prepare for catastrophic winds and flooding as Hurricane Maria moves closer. The hurricane is currently a Category 5 and is expected to start affecting the island tonight. The island of Dominica has already felt the fury of the storm, and officials are asking for helicopters so they can assess the damage. The governor there says the physical damage on the island is mind-boggling. Jeff Huffman is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. He joins us on Skype. Jeff, first of all, just give us the latest on the storm.
Well, Maria is still a dangerous Category 5 storm as of the advisory this morning from the National Hurricane Center. It's located only about 115 miles or even less than that now from the island of Guadalupe and about 125 miles from St. Croix. So it's starting to make its turn to the west-northwest and will be heading right for Puerto Rico. Unfortunately, the forecast track is for it to make a direct hit on the island of Puerto Rico.
Now, it was a Category 5 last night. It weakened overnight to a Category 4, then went back to Category 5. Do you expect it to continue to strengthen?
It might fluctuate some in intensity. I think the hurricane has potentially reached its maximum in terms of its wind speed and strength, but we can't really emphasize enough. There's not much of a difference between a strong Category 4 and a weak Category 5 in terms of the potential impact to land. It's going through a little bit of an eyewall replacement cycle, or it's expected to in the next 24 hours. It also had that brief interaction with the island of Dominica. So bottom line here, the story is this is going to be a very powerful, very dangerous, and potentially, these are the words of the National Hurricane Center, potentially catastrophic hurricane heading for Puerto Rico.
And when you look at a place like Puerto Rico or even St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands, which also is in the path. What is the risk? Is it about the winds from this storm? Is it about storm surge, or is it about rainfall, or all of them?
It's all of them. The only positive, if there is one with this, is that it's moving at a fairly steady pace. But then again, the tremendous amount of rain that a hurricane of this strength can cause will cause mudslides and potential flooding. And then the storm surge risk is more significant with this storm for the U.S. and British Virgin Islands than it was with Irma. The wind risk may be more significant for Puerto Rico, especially the eastern side of Puerto Rico, but they're going to be on what's called the right front quadrant of this hurricane, meaning that the forward motion of the storm combined with the wind speed is going to hit to the right of the path. But all four hazards that typically come with the hurricane, including the surge, the heavy rain, and the wind, and even the tornado risk in those outer bands on some of the other islands, it's all with this major hurricane.
What can people who are in the path of this storm do? If they're able to evacuate, obviously they can evacuate. But if they're not able to evacuate, how dangerous is this storm going to be, let's say, in Puerto Rico?
Well, time is almost run out in Puerto Rico to do any type of evacuation. And really, unfortunately, there's not a lot of places anyone's going to be able to go. I'd say if there's a chance to get to the western side of the island, you're going to be in a better spot than the eastern side. And if there's a chance to get to the northern side, you're going to be in a better spot than the southern side. But now it's time to hunker down. It's time to find the most sturdiest structure you can and the interior part of that structure. It's time to elevate yourself. Try to find the highest structure that you can safely get to if you're right along the coast.
I got an alert last night when Maria became a Category 5 that said a rare Category 5. And I thought to myself, is it really that rare anymore? We've already had a few this year.
We have. I think any type of context with these major hurricanes we've had this year, you have to remember that this has happened before. We had the record longest period without a major hurricane hit in the United States, but prior to Harvey. And then so, you know, a lot of times in the weather business, averages, very rarely do you have what's called an average or a normal season in anything, really. Those averages and normals are all obtained from the extremes on one side or the other. So it's not rare that we've had this many Category 5s, but it is unfortunate. And I think there's not a lot of science that goes into this. It's just happenstance. It is unfortunate that the major hurricanes have hit land areas this season, and very unfortunate that some of these same islands are experiencing two Category 5 storms in a matter of about 2.5 weeks.
That's Jeff Huffman, director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, in his speech to the UN General Assembly today, President Trump threatened North Korea with total destruction because of its nuclear missile program. He called Iran an economically depleted rogue state and a murderous regime. The president also said the U.S. and its allies are making progress against terrorists in the Middle East.
We have made big gains toward lasting defeat of ISIS. In fact, our country has achieved more against ISIS in the last 8 months than it has in many, many years combined.
Well, in the fight against ISIS in Syria, there is a page turning, according to Gail Zamaklamon, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She just made a trip to Syria for Defense One and PBS. And Gail, you write about how U.S. Special Forces, there are now about 1,000 in Syria, are heartened by the rebels, the Syrian Democratic Forces, they're training.
It really is the case that you see the special operations forces on the ground in Syria have almost the sense of relief, not at all because they're relaxed about the mission in any shape or form, but because it does seem that among the post-9/11 wars, this is the mission that is for them achievable and one that they feel like they are succeeding in, which is to train a local partner force to fight ISIS there on the ground in Syria.
And by the way, what's behind this? Is there a change in policy from Washington? What's going on?
There has been a loosening to some extent from the Trump White House to the Pentagon in terms of some authorities. I think people sometimes make that a little more dramatic than it is, but there has been more discretion given to commanders on the ground. So when I asked a special operations commander what has made the biggest difference, he said being able to bring more trainers into Syria to help the Syrian Democratic Forces, the U.S. is backing, build both the force that is fighting Raqqa and the force that is going to hold those cities afterward, more of a police force, what they call an internal security force.
Well, and you write that the Americans have real affection for these fighters, and you got to speak to some of them. What are they saying about how they see their role?
These fighters are young kids. I mean, they're 18, 19, 20. These young men, we met mostly men, there are women too, would say, really, you know, we want to fight for our country. We want to fight against ISIS. One young man told me about seeing beheadings in his neighborhood, about seeing his family humiliated, and about how he wanted to bring the fight to ISIS. And, you know, they get 2 weeks of training for this one force that we visited, and then they're on the front lines of a very brutal fight.
And there's an afterwards, which you say has had an impact as well, which is that there are councils set up in the towns that are liberated. There seems to be, instead of this kind of whack-a-mole sense of fighting, there seems to be a plan to resurrect the towns after ISIS is defeated.
This is what's so fascinating. Three words have always plagued the Syria conversation, which is, and then what? And what you see on the ground among the U.S.-backed forces is in towns that are liberated, you have these civil councils that have a woman who runs them and a man who runs them together. And they are really focused on the governance issue. And you see the U.S. military and special operations forces really focused on the governance issue because everyone is trying to learn the lessons of the post-9/11 wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And lousy governance helps breed insurgency. And you do have a sense on the ground that people understand that.
Well, but there's a fly in this ointment. And that is that a contingent of the fighters is the Kurds. We've talked here on the program about Kurdish women who are fighting. Turkey, you know, sees the Kurds as fighting in Syria to have their own, you know, liberation, their own nation state. Turkey's an ally of the U.S. How's that going to play out?
Robin, battlefield reality is about to meet geopolitical reality. And this has always been the question kind of looming over this whole U.S. effort to back Syrian Kurds, because the same forces that the U.S. really thinks are just key fighters who are making a difference in the fight against ISIS and who are a force for stability in the region are seen by Turkey as terrorists. And that geopolitical reality is really about to hit the entire ISIS campaign. And so you see U.S. military officials really trying to navigate the Turkey conversation and in some ways looking to see how they could bring Turkey into the fold to show them that the quickest way to make things difficult for Turkey and for the U.S. is to abandon Syrian Kurds.
And what I mean, you know, how do you think that's going to play out?
Stay tuned. Yeah. I think that there are conversations ongoing right now with Turkey about the fact that the U.S. really does see the Syrian Kurds as a force for stability. And special operations in particular sees them as a force for stability and trying to figure out, is there a way to guarantee Turkey that it will be secure even if the U.S. backs Syrian Kurds after the ISIS fight is over?
But I just want to touch on the fact that when you talk to these U.S. commanders, these special forces, they also see this as ending the Iraq war. They see this as a second generational war, that one they don't want a third generation to fight, their own kids. This is imperative for them that this be done right.
War is deeply personal, and we so rarely talk about it that way. And when you talk to these special operations commanders who have been formed and shaped and grown up in these post-9/11 wars, they will tell you, you know, this part of why we back this force is because we think they have the power to be an element of stability in the region. And we do not want our daughters, we do not want our sons fighting the same war.
Yeah. So accept the Kurds, they say, the military says. Gail Zamak-Laman, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her reporting in Syria was supported by the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. Terrific stuff. Gail, thank you.
Great to join you.
The mayor of St. Louis will meet with protesters tonight in a town hall meeting, the first since protests started Friday night following the acquittal of a former police officer who fatally shot a black man back in 2011. On Friday, the head of the NAACP in St. Louis urged President Trump and the Justice Department to review the decision, but the Justice Department had reviewed the case in 2012 and 2016 and decided not to prosecute. In addition, the Justice Department under Attorney General Jeff Sessions has announced plans to roll back a program that helps reform police departments and improve their relationships with the communities they serve. Joining us now is Carrie Johnson, NPR's justice correspondent. Hi, Carrie.
Happy to be here.
And what more can you tell us about this Obama-era effort to improve policing that Sessions is changing?
So, Jeremy, two things. Under the Obama administration, the Civil Rights Division took advantage of a law that had been on the books for a while, really since the brutal beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles, to allow the federal government to come in and do whole-scale pattern or practice investigations to find civil rights violations in entire police departments. That law hadn't been used very often before. Obama used it against something like 24 police departments earlier this year. New attorney General Jeff Sessions said he was not going to be using that law to investigate police. Instead, he wanted to be partners with state and local police since they comprise about 85% of the law enforcement officers around the country. More recently, Jeff Sessions has announced a change to a program called the COPS program. That stands for Community-Oriented Policing, and it's been around since 1994, the Bill Clinton era, initially designed to help pay for law enforcement officers in cash-strapped districts around the country. Under President Obama and his Civil Rights Division, those folks used the COPS program to enter into what they called collaborative agreements with police departments. Instead of coming in with a big stick, they came in with a carrot to look for problems, to work together with local police, and to provide some grant money to help. In fact, billions and billions of dollars since 1994 have gone to state and local police forces through that program. Jeff Sessions says he wants that money to now be focused on anti-gang crimes, anti-drug crimes. He wants to focus on what he sees as a return to law and order. So he's turning both of those programs around, wanting to be more of a partner with police than an investigator or an interrogator of them.
And when the experts have looked at that, the changes that the Sessions Justice Department wants, do they say that the Obama policies were effective in helping to make police departments operate better?
Some of those studies are still underway. There are some older studies of that COPS, community-oriented policing unit, that suggest it did help state and local police forces fight crime. But I talked with Ron Davis, who ran the COPS program in the Obama years. He says Obama did not turn away from crime fighting. In fact, if Jeff Sessions' point is to reduce crime, President Obama had already managed to reduce crime to near 30-year record lows. And the data we're expecting from last year seems to be in line with that, that violent crime may be spiking in some cities, but across the country, crime is still relatively low. So they question the motivation behind Jeff Sessions' moves here.
Do we have any idea what the impact these rollbacks by the Sessions Justice Department will have on the way local police departments address excessive use of force?
Interesting question. So the way that the federal government gets involved is when there's an allegation that local police have deprived someone willfully of their constitutional rights by using excessive force. The decision in St. Louis was that the federal government was not going to weigh in with any kind of federal criminal charges. In fact, these cases largely are state and local cases because most murders, most manslaughters are state and local charges, not federal ones. You need some kind of special hook to get into federal jurisdiction, like the murder would have to happen on federal land. It seems that The law is fairly settled here, and it's very, very difficult for either the federal government or a state or local government to successfully prosecute a police officer.
When we see the protests in St. Louis and people out on the streets who feel, and I don't want to oversimplify any one of these cases because they are all different, but who feel that justice is not being done, that police departments are not acting responsibly in a way that is fair, they feel in some cases that the federal government needs to step in. But it sounds like from what you're saying and what we're seeing from the Justice Department, that that is the opposite of what they are planning to do, is they want to keep the federal government out of these local police departments.
Well, there's a long history here, Jeremy. Going back to the heart of the civil rights struggles in the 50s and 60s, often a lot of local communities could not rely on their local police forces to bring them justice. So the federal government, the U.S. Justice Department, had to come in and offer help. That's what these communities are calling for again. Jeff Sessions has said that he will investigate any accusations of excessive force that meet the under federal law, that meet the legal standards there. But that's a very high bar. He's not going to move away from prosecuting individual bad actors, he says, but he's going to move away from the wholesale involvement of the Justice Department in investigating patterns or systems of misconduct in local police forces. And people like Sherilyn Eiffel of the Legal Defense Fund say that's a problem because policing depends on trust. And when you lose the trust of the community doesn't call 911 anymore.
Right. Do you expect any other changes on policing from the Sessions Justice Department?
There have already been a lot of them in only 8 months, Jeremy. We do expect a further debate in the Senate on Jeff Sessions' nominee to run the Civil Rights Division at Justice Eric Dryband. He's had a hearing. It was relatively non-controversial. And we're waiting for the Senate Judiciary Committee to hold a vote on him. Ultimately, the full Senate will have to confirm him. His nomination could be a process through which the Senate once again debates some of these policing issues vis-a-vis the Justice Department and the federal government.
That's NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson in Washington. Carrie, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, Major League Baseball's regular season is winding down. In Colorado, the Rockies are struggling to get to the playoffs for the first time since 2009. If they make it, the team will be in the spotlight, and so will its portly and cuddly mascot, the purple Triceratops Dinger. Colorado Public Radio's Vic Vella has more on the mascot some fans love to hate.
Let's start with one fact. People love dinosaurs. Think of the Flintstones and Jurassic Park. So, Rockies fans, it's gotta be cool that your team's mascot is a dinosaur, right? I mean, how many other teams can say their mascot was hatched from a giant egg in front of a sold-out crowd?
He's just kind of cheesy looking.
Seems a little too cartoonish, I guess.
Semi-worthless.
I just think he's kind of a dweeb.
Whoa, that was Paulogist, Daniel Combs, Tim Melton, and Dan Olds all dissing Dinger. Old says Dinger pales in comparison to other Colorado sports mascots.
I mean, like the other teams, like, you know, Miles for the Broncos is kind of intimidating. Rocky for the Nuggets is, you know, fun and goofy and messes around with fans. Dinger kind of just bounces around like Barney.
Asking Rockies fans their opinions on Dinger is kind of like bringing politics up at Thanksgiving. You get some seriously passionate responses, not just from haters, but from passionate defenders, too. Folks like Tyler Pruitt and his brother Dakota.
For people who are saying that Dinger is not exciting up are the people that just show up when the Rockies are winning.
Come on. Just him being a dinosaur is cool enough.
So why is Dinger a dinosaur? Well, for starters, when the Rockies Stadium Coors Field was under construction, crews actually dug up a dinosaur bone. Brady O'Neill supervises special events for the Rockies and handles all of Dinger's scheduling. He says given the bone finding and the Rocky Mountains' prehistoric history, a dinosaur mascot made a lot of sense.
The first ever Triceratops that was found anywhere in the world was actually found where Auraria campus is. So we are a hotbed of dinosaur activity. We are a dinosaur graveyard, the state of Colorado, and the area around us.
The Rockies held a naming contest for its new mascot, and the fans chose Dinger, which makes sense because it's a slang term for a home run.
This ball hit well to center field, and it is gone.
One of the biggest criticisms aimed at Dinger, other than the fact that he reminds some people of Barney, is that he doesn't do a lot of crazy antics, like when the Philadelphia Phillies Philly fanatic messes around with fans, or the Denver Nuggets Rocky flings basketballs toward the net from half court. Dinger just kind of keeps more of a low profile during games. Dan Price runs Adrenaline. It's a Denver-based company that does branding for sports organizations. He played a role in bringing Rocky to the Nuggets a couple decades back, but he says Dinger is a different animal. Pardon the pun.
I think he has a different presence. I think he has a different personality. And maybe that was what was important to the team, was they didn't want this competition between mascots. They just wanted to go down a different path and come up with something unique, and they did that very well.
8-year-old Eva agrees.
He's funny.
Why is he funny?
When I see him on the field, he does funny moves.
But Eva's grandma, Jill Melton, says she'd like the Rockies to go back to the drawing board and come up with something new.
Maybe, mountains. I don't know. Maybe a mountain lion. Mountain lion. That would be good.
What'd you say?
Mountain goat.
Mountain lion, mountain goat. There's a few ideas out there for Dinger replacements, but the Rockies aren't going to change mascots anytime soon. So, love him or hate him, the debate over Dinger the dinosaur is in no danger of going extinct, especially if the Rockies roar into the playoffs. For Here and Now, I'm Vic Vella in Denver.
When President Trump addressed the UN General Assembly today, he focused on the threats of terrorism, socialism, refugee crises. He called for a great reawakening of nations and took aim at the Iran nuclear deal.
The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it, believe me.
Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, good to be with you.
So the nuclear deal essentially requires Iran to keep its uranium stores to non-weapons grade and allow monitoring, then be rewarded with lifting sanctions. Supporters say it contains Iran. Critics don't trust it. There's a deadline to extend the deal mid-October. What's your sense after today?
So these deadlines come up because the U.S. has to continue to recertify that Iran is doing that based on what an independent global commission says. And the commission keeps on saying that Iran is keeping to that part of the deal. So where Donald Trump and Rex Tillerson are going with this is saying that there is another part of the deal that implies that Iran has to be a good neighbor and has to not foment unrest in the Middle East. And that's what Donald Trump's argument is, that he may not certify that Iran is keeping up to its deal because of other things that Iran is involved in the region. So by the letter of the law, Iran does seem to be sticking to the deal. Donald Trump has for months now been looking for some reason to tell them they're not.
Yeah, well, the deal was supposed to work based on those sanctions. Did those sanctions work?
I would say it's the absence of the sanctions and the threat of new sanctions has been very influential in Iran. The sanctions that were lifted in order to make this deal had been crippling. It had caused remarkable inflation. People were very unhappy. Now Iran is doing business with companies from other countries and has got a taste of it. So to some degree, yes, the threat of reimposing sanctions would be frightening to Iran, but fundamentally, Iran knows that this agreement, the Iran deal, was not a bilateral deal between the United States and Iran. It was a number of countries acting on behalf of the United Nations. So it would be much harder than it appears to be for Donald Trump to pull the plug on this.
Well, I know I'm going to ask you to switch to politics for just a second. President Trump's language today, do you think the president and his people think that threat will make Iran stop doing things like supporting the leader of Syria? I mean, what's the sense
Yeah, no. I think the one really instructive thing about the Iran deal that was, you know, worked on for a few years is that none of this tough talk works on anybody. The sanctions, the economic sanctions are what work. Remember, there have been 35 years plus of sanctions on Iran that were not effective. And all of a sudden, we pulled them off the SWIFT system so that they couldn't do bank exchanges and they couldn't use credit cards. That's what changed everything in Iran. And by the way, that's instructive for North Korea. So no, and Iran's president spoke to Lester Holt of NBC today and said, if America pulls out of this deal, why will anybody trust America in any other deals?
Right. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Researchers who have tracked brain injuries in professional football players have some sobering news for parents of young players. A study out today finds that children who start playing football at a young age face dramatically higher risks of future health problems in the brain. In the study, adults who started playing before age 12 were twice as likely to have problems with behavioral regulation or apathy and three times as likely to develop clinical depression. Dr. Robert Stern led the study, which was published in the journal Translational Psychiatry. He's the director of clinical research at Boston University's Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy Center. Dr. Stern, welcome to Here and Now. Dr. Stern, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks very much.
And first of all, tell us how you did this study. You obviously weren't looking directly at the brains of kids who play football.
No, this is a study of adults who were participating in a project called the Legend Study. And the average age was around 51 years old when they participated. And they had undergone a variety of cognitive tests on telephone and interviews, and they filled out these questionnaires about depression and behavior and apathy, things like that on the web. But we asked them a lot about their history of playing sports. And this group were ones who only played football as their main sport. And there were people who played up through high school, up through college, and then also some people who played through the pros. And we found out how many of them started playing tackle football before age 12 and compared that group to the ones who started at age 12 or older and looked at how they are doing now as adults on all those different types of tests.
And one of the things that you found is that people who started playing young were more likely to suffer from a range of neurological problems.
Well, in this case, they had a range of mood and behavior and problems and what we call executive dysfunction or problems with initiating and planning organization. So we weren't looking at the brain per se in this study. We've done that in the past with another study looking at this age of starting to play where we actually had brain scans. But in this case, it was just how are they functioning? What are their symptoms like as adults?
And the answer is?
And the answer is that these folks who started to play tackle football before age 12 had a threefold increased odds of having clinically meaningful depression symptoms and twofold clinically meaningful apathy and behavioral dysregulation, meaning not being able to control their behaviors and their impulses, as well as self-reported difficulties with this executive functioning.
And to be clear, this is not people who necessarily had concussions when they played football at age 12 or in their teens. This is just people who played.
Exactly. We're not looking at concussions. We're not as concerned about the symptomatic concussions when it comes to long-term consequences. What we're really concerned about, and what I think people really need to start being concerned about, is this exposure to what we refer to as subconcussive hits. These hits that don't necessarily result in a symptom right then, but people can get hundreds of them a year. Kids, youth, on average, have been found to have between 500 and 600 a year of these types of hits.
So does it make a difference in your study how long people played?
It didn't. And we statistically controlled for the number of years that everyone played. So it wasn't just that by starting younger, they had more years of play. So it wasn't the number of years. It also wasn't how high a level they played. So the same finding held true whether they played only up through high school, whether they played up through college, or whether they played in the pros.
Do we know what's going on at the biological level? Why these seemingly ordinary hits that might take place when you're playing football but don't lead to a concussion would cause so many problems years and years later?
That's what we're trying to figure out. You know, there's a couple things going on. Our group looks at this neurodegenerative disease, CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is kind of like Alzheimer's disease, but it's a unique disease. And it seems to start at that period of time when people are getting hit over and over again. And we're trying to understand exactly what the mechanism is. In this case, for this study, the concept is that we know from a lot of neuroanatomy research and development research that the brain is undergoing this incredible maturation and growth in the years between around 9 and 12 in boys. And so the feeling is that if it's going through all that growth and they're subject to getting hit after hit after hit, maybe that has some kind of long-term consequence, that there's this period of vulnerability in the brain's development.
Is that why 12 is the crucial year in your study?
Well, that's why we started to look at that year. It's based on previous research of ours also where we looked at just former NFL players and we looked at really in-depth neuropsychological testing as well as brain scans and found changes in the integrity of their brains between the ones who started before 12 or 12 or older. But we chose it because of the understanding of the peak periods of development, the previous research, but we also in our study now looked at age 11, looked at age 13, and 12 led to the most robust findings.
I think of football as something that people play in high school, play in college, play professionally. There are a lot of people who are pretty young in this country who play football.
Oh, they start really, really young. Pop Warner, USA Football. These kids start at age 5 and 6 putting on these big helmets with face masks that, you know, make them be bobbleheads. They can barely hold themselves up, and yet then they're asked to do these drills where they're hitting their heads against each other time after time after time. There's around over a million youth tackle football players in our country.
And I assume after this study, your advice to their parents would be don't let them play football.
No, not necessarily after this study. I don't think a single study really should determine policy change or dramatic recommendations. It's the growing evidence. But here's the thing. You know, we parents do all kinds of things to protect our kids. We do all kinds of crazy things to, you know, make sure that they're healthy, that they don't have injuries, that they reach their full potential. And then we drop them off at a field and put these helmets on and say, hit your head over and over again 500, 600 times per season. At a time when their brains are growing and developing, that most precious organ in our body. So my recommendation is think about that. You know, we can't take our kids away from athletics and exercise and sports. That's critical. They need to have that kind of exposure to great things and physical and emotional benefits. But we need to remove their exposure to hits to the head over and over again.
In the past, your studies on these kinds of issues have had a real impact on the national conversation about the risks associated with football. Do you think this one will as well?
I never know. I really never know. Again, the science is really in its early stages. We don't have definitive understanding of a lot of these things. The brain is so unbelievably complex, and we've just started looking at these long-term consequences of repetitive hits to it. I have no idea if this is going to change the conversation, move it forward. There's going to be less or more people playing. The study itself should not have that dramatic an impact. The conversation needs to be one of logic. Should we be exposing kids to repetitive brain trauma while their brains are developing?
Is it possible that these people that you looked at, who are, let's say, an average of 51 years old, have these problems for other reasons?
Yeah. So, you know, there's all kinds of potential variables that could have clouded the findings. So we try to statistically control for all those things. can't control for everything. So we look at their age, their education, their number of years they played, things like that. We looked at learning disabilities because sometimes people have criticized work like this saying, well, maybe it was kids with already vulnerable brains. So we statistically controlled for learning disabilities. The same findings came out. There are so many potential possible reasons that what we're seeing may not be true. We tried to deal with that as much as we can, and the findings were pretty striking.
That's Dr. Robert Stern, who is the director of clinical research for Boston University's Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy, or CTE, Center. We'll link you to more about this study at hereandnow.org. Dr. Stern, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
After Hurricane Harvey nearly drowned Houston, we asked what might be in that water. Superfund runoff, sewage, paint from people's sheds. Well, now we know more. The New York Times recently partnered with researchers at the Baylor College of Medicine and Rice University, along with the City of Houston Health Department, to test water samples. Sheila Kaplan covers health and science for the New York Times. She was among the journalists who commissioned the study. Many of them paddled out to help the scientists collect samples. Her article, "Houston's Floodwaters Are Tainted," tells what they found. Sheila, what was in the water?
Well, astonishing levels of E. coli, which means that there's raw sewage in people's houses. What we were able to do that no one had done before was test water inside some houses, right, not just outside.
Well, I'm going to give an example. In one home, this was along the Buffalo Bayou, there were levels 135 times those considered safe of E. coli.
Yes, and the people didn't realize that it was that dangerous. We tested a house that had 7 feet of water, and the water was so high that the people were not coming back in yet, so they were not in immediate danger. But their neighbors, who had water that had already receded, were living on the second floor and just putting up with the smell. But the problem is, it's not just the smell. The smell is indicative of bacteria and other dangerous substances, especially to children.
We'll talk about some of the other substances you found in the water.
We found lead. We found arsenic. We found chromium. That's the Aaron Brockovich movie chemical. Mm-hmm. And we don't have all the results back yet from the Superfund sites. The Superfund sites flooded. That means that the chemicals spilled over and were carried by the water down into people's houses and possibly into people's water wells.
Well, and you did this testing because there is testing ongoing by the state, I believe, but the results haven't been released. If you could get these results, the Times reporters, who I understand that initially you thought you could do it yourself, just go out with some containers and collect some water, and then you realized you needed to form this team around you. But if you could do it and get some results, some are still pending, why aren't people getting more results?
Well, we don't know why people aren't getting more results, and I can tell you that the Houston Health Department is upset that they've been having such a hard time getting results from the state and from EPA. I have no idea why EPA will not release what they have. All EPA has done is say, we think this site is okay, we think this site might have some problems, and we're working on it. But they're not telling anyone what the problems are. And even the Houston health officials don't know. It was actually the Houston Health Department that selected areas for us to test because they wanted to know what the residents were exposed to.
Well, and you tested with a lab that often does federal testing. But you and your colleague, Jack Healy, met people like, looking at Roderick Francis, who's living with his wife and 4 kids in Clayton Homes. Mm-hmm. Had no idea that there was any contamination.
That's right. One family we spoke to, Maria Sotolongo, who lives with her husband and 3 children in an upscale neighborhood in Houston, was very upset when we gave her the results of what we found because she was there with her children trying to clean out the house. And she said, nobody told us not to come.
And there's other issues. There's mold that's now growing all over couches in living rooms. People with asthma are having problems as anticipated. If you have a cut or a sore, some of this stuff that's in the water is getting in those cuts. People are being treated at area hospitals for that. Talk about something that, you know, who would think of sand. There's going to be something that looks like sand when the water recedes. It's not.
That's right. It's not sand. And you shouldn't let your kids make sandcastles out of it because it's got neurotoxins. It's got lead, which can affect intelligence. It's got arsenic, which can cause all kinds of developmental problems in children. What happens is, you know, a lot of parents are inside the house trying to clean it, and they leave the kids outside, and the kids are jumping around in these huge piles of debris, you know, upside-down refrigerators and chairs and couches and drenched stuffed animals.
And things like that. Well, as health officials told you, this isn't sand that's all piled around this stuff. It's sludge sediment, and it's got to be removed. So just quickly, what's the piece of advice you got to tell people since you are now finding out that all of these toxins are there?
You have to go into your house with a mask and gloves and waders and get it cleaned out as fast as you can, and keep an eye on the kids outside so they're not looking for their lost toxic toys. Mm. Also, the health department advises people to get rid of their furniture if it's been flooded. Just because it's dry doesn't mean it's safe.
Yeah. Sheila Kaplan covers health and science for the New York Times, part of the team that commissioned scientists to test the water that was left after Houston flooded. They still have more testing coming in. Sheila, we look forward to seeing your writing on that. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Robin.
Jeremy, it's just such a reminder as Hurricane Maria approaches Puerto Rico, people still wrestling with the results of Harvey in Houston. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.